Chapter 10. The trail the bounty hunters followed was a grim one, a path of ash and ruin littered with the wreckage of human bodies. The smoke that had beckoned them away from the south had been rising from a small box canyon, the fire still chewing away at whatever brush and twisted trees yet remained. The floor of the valley was a blanket of ash, reminding Olgrin of the volcanoes that sometimes misbehaved in the southern stretches of the World's Edge Mountains. Poking up from the black cinders were broken bones and slabs of heat-ravaged steel. The devastation was obvious, the power of the force that had wrought it almost beyond belief. Brunner quickly tired of the morbid game of counting helmets, in an attempt to decide how many knights had fallen here. Much of the armor was so warped and blackened by the dragon's fire that it was difficult even to determine sometimes if what he thought to be a helm might not instead be a breastplate or a piece of barding. The far end of the valley was heaped with the bones and burnt carcasses of hundreds of cattle.
"Quite an appetite that lizard has,"
Olgrin commented, but even his jest was half-hearted, voiced to try and fend away the dread that was building within the normally stalwart dwarf. They did not linger long in the valley, following still more distant columns of smoke rising in the east. For the rest of the day, the three hunters found themselves journeying from one scene of tragedy and ruin to another. Here, a farmstead blasted into a crater. There, an orchard, its trees stripped and barren in the aftermath of the dragon's flame. Once, they had come upon what seemed to be a knight sitting beside a road. Ithilwale had dismounted to investigate the man when he did not respond to Olgrin's call. She did not speak of what lay behind the knight's visor when she lifted it, saying only that the warrior was dead. They made camp that night beside a narrow gorge overlooking the river Grismary. Brunner selected the ground because it made a good defensible position, the severe drop effectively forming a bulwark against attack from the south and the west. Unless, of course, the attacker was able to fly, such as a dragon. Of course, if that were the case, Brunner knew firsthand that even a castle was no stronghold against such a creature. Ithilwale again stared out into the night, as though trying to cast her gaze far enough to see the creature whose tracks they followed. There was no faint glow upon the horizon, no thick pall of smoke marring the night wind. Ithilwale took that to mean that the dragon had settled down somewhere, perhaps resting after indulging its lust for destruction. But she knew that it would only be a matter of time before the worm roused itself once more and the fires burned anew. "Ithilwale." The elf turned as she heard Brunner call out her name. The bounty hunter was seated before the fire, still wearing his armor and weapons, having removed only his helmet. Nearby, Olgrin sat on a mossy stone, chewing nervously at a pipe protruding from his beard.
"You gave a name to that monster. Can you tell us more about it? If Gabineau decides to call on it again, I'd like to know as much as possible about what we will be facing."
The elf glided across the campsite, sitting upon the ground beside the fire.
"Much of what I know about him is rumor, the rest speculation."
Ithilwale paused, collecting her thoughts.
"The dragon's name is Malok, a name that is heaped with horror and suffering."
"Bah! Malok is known to my people as well," interrupted Olgrin. "The name itself is from the old Khazalid. It means malice, and you'll find that there is an entire page in the Book of Grudges with that gold-stealing lizard's name upon it."
"Perhaps he had another name in the tongue of my people," Ithilwale said, "but if so, that given to him by the dwarves soon displaced it. It is known that when war broke out between my people and the dwarves..."
The elf paused, expecting some surly outburst from Olgrin,
but he remained silent. The dragon served the prince of my people, who had settled in the lands now known as the Grey Mountains. I can now imagine how the prince caused Malak to serve him, for surely he was one of the exiled renegade lords of Kalador.
It would figure that there would be elf sorcery at the back of all this.
Olgrin grunted, spitting a blob of spittle into the fire.
Then this prince was the one who created the Felfang? Brunner asked.
Or had it made for him, Ithilwell said. But it would have been his will that made the artifact work, the strength of his own soul that bound the dragon to him. The fell fangs are terrible things, dominating the spirit of one creature by crushing it with the will of another. That was why they were denounced by the rulers of Ulthuan. And they are dangerous, even for the most strong-willed, for control is never assured. It is easier, less taxing to force a dragon to do something that it is in its nature, but far more difficult to subdue its own urges. There was also speculation that the imposing of spirits might not be a one-way door as the Fell Fang was designed to be. It might be possible for the dragon's fiery spirit to bleed over into the body of the one using the artifact. In any case, control is tenuous at best, and once lost, the ire of the dragon will focus itself upon the possessor of the artifact, for it will be able to sense the exact location of the fang's user, however great the distance.
So, our reptilian friend might have had a fair journey when Gobineau called him to Musilon,
Brunner observed. But next time the dragon will be closer, have less distance to travel, and be there much sooner.
Yes, agreed the elf. Without a powerful will to restrain him, Malak will find the Fell Fang, kill the one using it, and probably level everything within 100 miles. There are few among even the oldest and noblest of my people who would be able to restrain a creature like Malak, for his power and malevolence can only have increased through the ages. Among men, I don't think such strength exists. I am certain that if it does, it is not nestled within the avaricious dung heap that your Gobineau employs as his soul.
Leave it to the elves to create something anybody can use, but nobody can control.
Olgrin swore, spitting again into the fire. What I still do not understand, Brunner said, is how this elf prince ever lost control of Malak.
He used Malak against the dwarves when there was war between our two people, Ithilwell replied. The scars that so easily identify the worm were given to him during that conflict, as the prince drove him against his enemies. The wound along Malak's belly was earned when the shaft hurled by a dwarf bolt-thrower nearly skewered the dragon during the Battle of Elendil's Hill. Such was the potency of whatever runes the dwarf smiths placed upon the enormous spear that even a dragon, centuries later, still bears the scar. The other wound was inflicted during the scourging of the dwarf stronghold, our chronicles named Iron Peak. A jagged bolt of sorcerous lightning called down upon Malak by the high priest of the dwarves.
Aye, agreed Olgrin. And well do we dwarves remember that day, when the elf's pet monster gobbled up one of the oldest and wisest runesmith in the kingdom.
Olgrin ground his teeth together.
That's a crime both the dragon and those who set him upon us will answer for one day.
But that does not tell me how and why they lost control of the dragon, Brunner interrupted, hoping to stem the brewing argument between elf and dwarf.
It was decided to abandon the war after the Phoenix King was slain at Tor Alesi, the enchantress said. The war with the dwarves was taking too high a toll, the killing far too senseless for my people to endure any longer. It was decided to abandon the colonies, to return to Ulthuan. A great exodus of my people left the towered places and shining cities they had built for themselves here, to board the ships that would carry them back to the lands of their birth. The elf prince who controlled Malak charged his monster with guarding and watching over his people as they marched toward the shore. But protection and preservation was not a thing that came easily to Malak. The dragon longed to kill and destroy, as he had when waging war against the dwarves. The ordeal of restraining Malak's rebellion would have taxed the prince day and night, until at last his control was lost. There was a tremendous pride within the fiery heart of a dragon, and Malak must have despised sharing in the stigma of the retreat. Perhaps it was this injured pride that at last enabled him to overcome the control of the fell fang. However it came about, Malak slew his master and then set about destroying every elf he could find, raining fire down upon the weary refugees as they slowly crept toward the sea.
"Then at least the old lizard did some good,"
Olgrin muttered, clearly less sympathetic to Ithilwale's tale of woe.
"Perhaps the records in the Book of Grudges are a bit too harsh on him. It sounds to me as if this fell fang is more of a curse than a blessing," Brunner observed. "We may just be doing Gobineau a service by relieving him of it."
The bounty hunter stopped speaking as Ithilwale suddenly shot to her feet, frightened eyes scoring the darkness beyond the campfire. Brunner had enough experience with the sharp senses of the elves to know better than to question them. In an instant, he too was on his feet, the cruel length of Drake's Malice in his hand. A moment later, the horses and Olgrin's mule began to stamp their hooves and voice their own unease as some faint scent offended them. Olgrin rose slowly, a sturdy hand axe gripped in each of his meaty fists.
"Any idea what has the animals upset?"
the dwarf asked from the corner of his mouth.
"You don't think the lizard is hungry again?"
he added in a subdued tone.
"No,"
Ithilwale told him. "But what is waiting out there in the night is just as much an abomination." Brunner noticed the familiar quality of fear and loathing that edged the elf's voice. Shifting his grip on his sword, the bounty hunter lowered his left hand, unobtrusively palming a small object secreted beneath his vambrace. A tall figure stalked out from the shadows. The intruder's heavy steps crunched into the dirt, betraying the fact that heavy armor pressed down upon his steel-shod feet. The faint smell that had alarmed the animals grew more pronounced, rising to such a stink that it carried itself to the much less discerning senses of Brunner and Olgrin. It was a smell both warriors had encountered many times before. The rank stink of death, the vapor of an old battlefield. Both bounty hunters stepped closer to the fire, careful to keep their eyes averted from the flame and ruining their night vision. By degrees, a single baleful eye could be seen, twinkling from the dark shape as it reflected a fire, cat-like.
"A fine tail you spin,"
a fell, postulant voice hissed from the darkness.
"For a faithless elf slut."
Ithilwale visibly flinched as she heard a grotesquely distorted, yet sickeningly familiar and hated voice.
"You said much that interested me,"
the vampire continued.
"Enough so that I would have a few questions answered before I rip the lying tongue from your pretty face."
"It's Corbus,"
Ithilwale breathed with horror. The enchantress retreated slowly, retracing her steps so that she stood beside Brunner. The bounty hunter took a step forward, lifting Drake's Malice so that the blade interposed itself between the enchantress and the vampire.
"There is reason enough for me to spill your life,"
Corbus growled at Brunner. The vampire knight strode into the circle of light cast by the campfire. Ithilwale gasped in shock as she saw the vampire's mutilated face.
A pulpy mass of pus-hued filth was beginning to fill the warped, ruined socket. Raw lengths of tendon and muscle had begun to reattach themselves to the vampire's shattered jaw. The vampire smiled, displaying his fangs and further distorting his already mangled features.
It will take many nights feasting on the thin blood of peasants to restore my face.
Corbus spat.
How will you fare after I peel yours from your skull, assassin?
Brunner kept silent, evaluating the foul knight of the blood dragons. Despite a hideous injury to his face, Corbus moved with a grace and strength that would put a professional dancer to shame, and he did so wearing a suit of heavy crimson plate armor that might have been the twin to that destroyed by Olgrin's battle axe. The thick Bretonian broadsword, clutched in the vampire's mailed fist, was held against the creature's side, but Brunner was not deceived. He had seen the monster in action before, and knew that, with his inhuman speed, the vampire's unguarded pose was nothing more than an illusion.
"Kill him slowly, Brunner,"
Olgrin snarled.
"That scum owes me a battle axe."
Despite the dwarf's bravado, Brunner noted that his fellow bounty killer was steadily backing away from the approaching vampire. He could not be certain if the dwarf was intent on his gear, intent on equipping himself with something more imposing than a hand axe, or if his mule and the speedy departure was Olgrin's intention. The bounty hunter was unwilling to turn his gaze from Corbus long enough to make certain.
"Your filthy blood is not even worth taking,"
Corbus hissed at the dwarf.
"Had you kept that foul tongue silent, I might have even allowed you to continue to defile the ground upon which you walk. Now I shall simply gut you like the vermin you are."
The vampire's burning eyes turned away from Olgrin, staring past Brunner at the enchantress sheltering behind him.
"From you I shall hear more of this man who calls dragons. I am most eager to meet him." "The only one you meet this night is Mor," Brunner roared, lunging forward, slashing at the vampire with the edge of Drake's malice.
With almost contemptuous ease, Corbus blocked the blow, the strength of the vampire's arm causing the bounty hunter's longsword to tremble. With his sword grinding against Brunner's own, the blood dragon's other hand closed about the bounty hunter's throat, undead talons clasping living flesh within a clutch of steel.
"You should have stuck to your tricks, assassin,"
the vampire snarled. Corbus's jaw cracked as the vampire's mouth snapped open far beyond the limits imposed upon it in life. The gleaming, wolf-like fangs shone like polished ivory in the flickering firelight as Corbus brought his ruined face toward Brunner's exposed neck.
"Who says I gave up my tricks?"
Brunner managed to choke beneath the vampire's grasp. His left hand flashed forward, a white cloud billowing about the mutilated half of Corbus's face. A near-piercing shriek erupted from the vampire's mouth as the creature recoiled, dropping Brunner to the ground. Greasy gray smoke steamed from the vampire's injuries, carrying with it the reek of burning meat. Brunner did not pause to recover from the vampire's brutal grip, instantly lunging forward, swiping at the monster with Drake's malice, even as his other hand removed an object from his belt. Even in the midst of his agony, the skills and instincts of the lifelong warrior exerted themselves, and Corbus brought his own sword around in a parrying stroke that easily batted Brunner's blade aside. But with one hand still clutching at a sizzling wreckage of his face, Corbus left his other side exposed. The bounty hunter had put little force behind his feint with Drake's malice, saving his energy for the true attack. The polished length of the wooden stake he had bought from a disgraced priest of Sigmar in the Tylian port of Miragliano dug into the vampire's side, sinking into the gap between the breast and back plates. The vampire shrieked again as Brunner drove the stake into his unclean flesh. The bounty hunter danced backward as Corbus lashed out at him with an ungainly slash from his broadsword. The blood dragon staggered back, gasping and snarling as he fought against the pain assaulting him. Corbus glared at the bounty hunter, his single remaining eye boring into Brunner's own. Then the undead knight lifted his broadsword once more, holding it as though it were a lightweight javelin, being readied for a cast. Brunner's hand hovered near the butt of the pistol. He would have no chance of matching the speed of the vampire, but if the creature was as pained as it seemed to be, he might be able to exceed it in the matter of accuracy. A loud crack and roar from the other side of the camp decided the question. Before Corbus could hurl his sword, the vampire was thrown back, his breastplate exploding as an iron bullet smashed into it. Having backed to the far side of the camp, the vampire was fortuitously poised near the edge of the gorge. The impact of the bullet was enough to knock him over the edge. The vampire's wail of frustrated rage echoed from below as he plummeted down towards the banks of the Grismary. Brunner turned to find Olgrin Balax sitting on the ground, smoke rising from the wide-barreled mouth of a huge rifle, a dwarf weapon known as a Thunderer, for the imposing noise its discharge created. The recoil from the weapon had knocked Olgrin from his feet, landing him on his backside. The dwarf grumbled into his beard as he struggled to regain his dignity.
5 gold crowns for the cost of powder, shot, and accuracy,
Olgrin declared once he was on his feet again.
To come from your share, naturally.
Brunner shook his head.
I don't think so,
he told the dwarf. Your throat would have been next on his list. Chalk it down to the cost of staying alive.
Olgrin snickered, leaning on the broad mouth of his weapon, then recoiling when he found it to still be hot.
You don't get me that easily, he said. That bloodsucker would have been after Tolliers next. More than enough time for me to slip away, if I was of a mind to.
Mention of Ithilwill caused Brunner to look back at the elf. She still stood in the same spot to which she had retreated to avail herself of Brunner's protecting sword. As the bounty hunter stepped nearer, he could see the unfocused glaze in her eyes, near the faint, musical words whispering through her lips. Carefully, Brunner reached forward, placing his hand on the elf's shoulder. Instantly, the melody stopped, and Ithilwale's eyes regained their normal vibrancy.
Thank you,
the bounty hunter told her, guessing at the purpose of her incantation. It had been more than pain dulling the vampire's unnatural speed and reflexes. Ithilwale took several deep breaths, trying to restore her composure after her hasty spellcraft.
It is always dangerous to draw upon the winds of magic when the sun is past and the dark powers are in their ascendancy, she stated. But to allow you to have been slain by that abomination would have been far worse.
She gave Brunner an approving look.
That was a clever trick, hurling salt into the monster's face.
I told you that I like to know about my enemy,
the bounty hunter replied. I've had dealings with such creatures before, and after my first encounter with one, I determined to learn its weaknesses. He looked back at the edge of the precipice.
By itself, the salt would have only pained him, but the wooden shaft I drove through his side was crafted for the express purpose of destroying his kind, blessed by the priests of Sigmar, if the good intentions of priests and gods have any merit.
Then that is the last we'll be seeing of that leech,
Olgrin commented.
Let us hope so,
Ithilwale replied, a haunted quality of uncertainty in her voice.
But I should feel much better if we were far away from this place.
I don't think any of us would get much sleep knowing that the thing's body is down below.
Brunner agreed, replacing Drake's Malice into its sheath. We'll risk a bit of night travel. Who knows? The bounty hunter observed with grim humor. We may even find ourselves sharing the same inn as Gobineau. There were 5 rogues in Hubolt's little mob, though Gobineau would not have put much stock in any of them should problems arise. 2 of them looked old enough to be Hubolt's father, if any man had ever cared to accept that dubious honor. Another was young enough that Gobineau wondered if his chin had ever considered sprouting hair yet. The other 2 were little different from the simple peasant rabble he'd shared the inn with the previous night, though they wore swords at their belts. None of these men had that ruthless, predatory air, the chill in their eyes that marked the veteran bandit. Whatever notoriety these men had garnered was due entirely to their leader. Still, Gobineau knew that such men were easily manipulated. Lacking the proper experience or cunning to think for themselves, they were apt to follow most any command before questioning the intent behind it. No, Gobineau would have nothing to fear from such a quarter. Hubolt, however, might be a different matter. If he was reduced to allowing such men to call him captain, then the bandit must have fallen much farther than he had admitted to at the inn. Probably not much thievery either, beyond some poaching and rustling. Hubolt would indeed bear watching. It would only take the tiniest spark of ambition to cause the man to think of better things. The bearded bandit stared back at Gobineau from the forefront of their small column. They were riding through a narrow strip of woods, skirting the edge of a vast tract of farmland. After some discussion, the 2 had decided that Gisoreau might make a more viable base of operations than Canel. Apparently, the predations of the dragon had disturbed more than just the knights. There were tales that the worm's presence had driven twisted beastmen from their lairs deep within the forest of Chalon. Hubolt was not willing to put such rumors to the test, and after seeing the man's company of rogues, Gobineau was inclined to agree with him. He'd not trust such men against a mob of children. Besides, if beastmen were roaming about the countryside near Canal, then the peasants would already have troubles enough to concern them than the threat of a dragon destroying their homes. "Now, friend," Hubolt said, his lips twisted into a grotesque leer because of the brand marring his face. "We've yet to discuss the split for this scheme of yours." It was a topic that had been suggested a few times. Gobineau noticed that Hubolt's demeanor was becoming more unruly the deeper into the country they rode. Perhaps the bandit was already starting to decide that he didn't need his partner. Gobineau had hoped to delay that eventuality a little longer. "Since I have my 5 men to think about, perhaps I should receive the larger..." Whatever percentage Hubolt was about to mention was lost in the strangled cry that rose from his throat. A red-feathered arrow protruded from the brigand's chest, its momentum knocking him from the saddle and spilling him onto the road. Gobineau did not spare a second look for his erstwhile ally, but quickly scanned the road ahead. Emerging from cover were a 6 leather-clad archers, an armored knight with a horned helmet mounted upon a great black war horse behind them. However, it was the mounted man seated next to the knight that caused Gobineau's breath to fall short. How Rudel had found him was not quite so important as to what the wizard wanted and was likely to do in the way of getting it. Just the same, even as his instinct of self-preservation stirred, another emotion began to assert itself. The desire to crush these men who dared oppose him, to still their hearts and leave their burning carcasses smoldering beneath the sun. Gobineau caught himself just as he began to put spurs against the side of his horse to initiate his mad and suicidal intention. With terror, Gobineau fought down the insane aggression that had flared up within him. He was not about to lose his life fighting knights and wizards. Not when there were others to fight his battles for him.
"Ride them down before they can fire again!"
Gobineau shouted, drawing his sword and waving it above the neck of his horse like some Kislevite cavalry officer. Hubold's vermin did not think twice, but dug their spurs into their mounts and charged forward. Gobineau had to hand it to Hubold. At least he had an eye for collecting morons. The outlaw turned his own mount around with a savage tug at the reins. With any luck, the sacrifice of Hubold's men would buy him enough time to put some distance between himself and the wizard. Rudol glared down at Sir Fierswind. The knight had dismounted, prowling amongst the bodies of the men his archers had slaughtered, checking each one of them for the object the wizard had described for him so often since they had left the Chateau de Chagny. The wizard fairly burned with irritated frustration, enraged at this arrogant swordsman's stupidity. Rather than listening to the wizard, rather than hastening with all speed after the man who had escaped, Fierswind had insisted on searching the bodies of the slain for the fell fang, sending only two of his men in pursuit of the escaped man. Fierswind made no secret of his distrust of the wizard, suspecting Rudol's every suggestion and warning him that any deception on his part would be reported back to the Viscount.
"It seems you were right,"
Fierswind conceded as he rose from the last corpse.
"We should have pursued the man who escaped."
There was no note of apology in the knight's voice. Indeed, if anything, his tone was even more arrogant and hostile than before.
"And what will you do now?"
Rudolf sneered. Fierswind glared back from behind his helm.
"We question the one who is still alive,"
the knight snarled back. Two of the men-at-arms dutifully lifted the injured Hubold from the ground, the arrow still sticking from his chest.
"Who was the man who escaped?"
Fierswind demanded. The bandit gave the knight a mocking smile. Fierswind closed his armored hands into fists.
"Tell me, or..."
"Or what?"
Hubold wheezed.
"You'll kill me?" "You've already done that, so there's no reason to fear you now."
The bandit began to laugh heartily, enjoying the knight's impotent rage. But the laughter passed into a shriek of mortal agony as violet energy blazed into the arrow, searing through the wooden shaft into Hubold's body. Seeing what was happening to their captive, the soldiers backed away. Sparks of energy rippled about Hubold's body. Smoke rose from the stricken man, whose body twitched and shuddered as though seized by a fit. The magical lightning continued to stream into Hubold until the man's body began to cook from the inside out. His screaming voice crackled with the shrillness of its tormented shrieks. Only then did the sorcerer's attack subside, allowing the corpse to topple to the singed earth. Fierswind and his men looked with open horror upon Rudol as the wizard straightened himself in the saddle, the last flickers of power fading from his eyes. It was his turn to indulge in arrogance, now that he had shown the knight and his scum just who was in command of this little enterprise, that he could destroy each and every one of them with a simple gesture of his hand.
"We will do as I say now,"
Rudol declared, daring Fierswind to protest. The knight did not rise to the lure, earning himself a reprieve from Rudol's wrath.
"The thief who has the fell fang knows we are after him. He will seek to lose himself in the nearest city. We will need to stop him before he can do so."
"And how do we accomplish this?"
Sir Fierswind managed to ask. Rudol smiled at him indulgently, as though the knight were no more than an idiot child.
"My magic will tell me where the fang is, always,"
Rudol stated. Then a broad smile began to spread on the wizard's features.
"Perhaps two men were enough," he hissed. "It appears that our prize is coming back to us."
Brunner dismounted from Fiend, taking a closer look at one of the red-feathered arrows lying beside the bodies of the slain men. They had chanced upon a shepherd who recalled having seen Gobineau pass his fields, riding in the company of a half a dozen men with ill-favored looks. It was a simple matter to follow the trail of the riders until it at last led them into a stretch of woods and the massacre they now gazed upon.
"Looks like our bandit met some of his fellows,"
Algren observed with grim humor.
"No honor among thieves, eh?"
he hissed over at Ithilwale. The elf enchantress seemed distracted, out of sorts ever since they had come upon the ghastly scene.
"This was not done by a pack of bandits," Brunner stated. The bounty hunter's voice was laced with such intense hatred that Olgrin's hand instinctively fell to the small axe nestled beneath his belt. Brunner snapped the shaft of the arrow he had been examining. The dwarf wondered at the sudden change in his partner. What could there have been about a simple arrow that could get under the skin of so cold a character as the infamous Brunner? Olgrin did not know, but suspected that such information might be of great interest, and possibly of even greater profit.
"I see,"
the dwarf commented, stabbing a finger at the charred remains lying in the middle of the road.
"Our dragon has taken up archery as a hobby."
"This was not done by the dragon," Ithilwale stated. "That poor man was struck down not by dragon fire, but by the darkest magic."
Brunner looked at the corpse, giving it only the briefest of examinations. It was too large to be the man they were hunting. Beyond that fact, he had no interest. The bounty hunter remounted his warhorse.
"I've seen a man who could work such sorcery," he declared when he had regained the saddle. "We are not the only ones hunting Gobineau."
"Then someone else has already claimed the bounty,"
Olgrin grumbled, immediately contemplating the expense of time and effort that he had wasted pursuing the outlaw. Brunner shook his head.
"I don't think the wizard and his allies are interested in the bounty," he told the dwarf. "They are after the Fell Fang, as Ithilwale is."
He stared intently at the tracks leading away from the massacre.
"It looks as if they might have gotten what they were after, too."
"Then we must find them quickly,"
Ithilwale told the bounty hunters.
"The Fell Fang in the hands of a fool who doesn't know what he has is bad enough, but it is much more dangerous in the possession of someone who actually thinks he knows what it is."
Brunner stared back at the red-feathered arrows, remembering another time he had seen them sprouting from the bodies of fallen men.
"We'll find them," the bounty killer said confidently. "Gobineau was with these men. It is likely he is now the prisoner of the ones who killed his comrades. That actually makes our job easier. Gobineau is an outlaw, a man so used to covering his tracks that it comes as easily as breathing to him. The men who have captured him are not. They are knights, trained warriors too arrogant to cover their tracks, too certain of their own abilities to bother about such things."
"We'll find them," Brunner repeated. "My concern is, what will be waiting for us when we do?" The waning light cast by the setting sun did little to disconcert the croaking ravens gathered about the broken corpse. The hungry birds had been drawn by the smell of death hovering over the lands in which the dragon now roamed. But there was little left in Malok's wake upon which to feed, only cinders and ash. So it was that a body lying upon the sandy bank of the Grismary River provided a welcome meal for many hungry creatures. For long hours, the sharp beaks pecked away at the exposed flesh, trying to dig fresh morsels from beneath the coat of steel plate that encased much of the corpse. One raven picked at the back of the face-down corpse's neck, throwing its head back and letting another sliver of meat slide down its gullet. But the bird had eaten its last. With the retreat of the sun, a new vitality filled the dread being, sprawled beneath the raven's claws. The bird croaked in fright, but as it rose to take flight, a powerful grip closed about it. The raven struggled to free itself, even as its former meal shifted its body and rose from the sand. Corbus glared at the scavenger, then lifted the struggling bird to his mangled, freshly burned face. The vampire's jaws clamped about the raven's body, swiftly draining it of the tiny amount of blood coursing through its veins. It was a pathetic meal, and did nothing to satisfy the vampire's growing thirst. But it would nourish the monster, give him strength to find other, more satisfactory prey. The undead knight threw the broken bird from him, then closed his hands about the wooden shaft protruding from his side. It had been a near thing. The treacherous assassin had nearly killed him with his dishonorable deceits. The salt had badly burned his already mutilated face, but the stake had come near to destroying him. Only the mail he wore beneath his plate armor had prevented the bounty hunter's blow from piercing deep enough to penetrate his heart. To come so close to destruction, when he was so near to redemption, was a thought that made Corbus seethe with fury. The assassin would suffer for the indignities he had heaped upon him. By the oaths he had sworn to the blood dragons, Brunner would be a long time in meeting his end. The vampire's jaws distended to utter a long, painful howl, as, with a tremendous effort, Corbus ripped the stake from his body, casting it into the swift-moving waters of the Grismarie.